President Obama has been hosting meetings at the White House about what to do about the so-called fiscal cliff, today he takes his message on the road with a trip to a factory in Montgomery County outside of Philadelphia. It not only weathered the recession, it has hired new employees who make toys, a perfect photo op for the president. Meanwhile, back in Washington, Republicans are saying no to Mr. Obama's proposal to let tax cuts expire for those making more than $250,000. House Leader John Boehner wants to cut Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security and close tax loopholes and eliminate deductions, something most Democrats oppose. Well, today on Radio Times, we want to talk fiscal cliff politics with Robert Samuelson and James Peterson. Samuelson is a columnist for the Washington Post, syndicated by the Washington Post Writers Group. His most recent book is The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath, The Past and Future of American Affluence. Robert Samuelson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be with you.
Also with us, as I said, James Peterson. He's director of Africana Studies, associate professor of English at Lehigh University, a contributor to The Griot, and a frequent guest on MSNBC, frequent guest on Radio Times as well. Nice to have you back with us.
Good morning.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Robert, since you're down there in Washington, D.C., are we seeing some public pronouncements that maybe belie the fact that there's some behind-the-scenes negotiations going on?
Well, there might be. I really don't know, to be honest with you. Years ago, when I came to Washington, my grandmother would always ask me, what's going on in Washington? I'd say, Grandma, I don't know any more than you do. if there's stuff going on behind the scenes, it's quite behind the scenes. In the stories I read this morning, there's no indication that there's a kind of parallel negotiation going on with the public meetings that have occurred. Now, as I say, there might be, but at this point, they're well hidden if they exist.
And what would happen? I do want to get, James, you in the conversation, but Robert, what would happen if the country goes over this so-called fiscal cliff, that on January 1st there is not an agreement?
Well, if there is no agreement on January 1st, a number of events will occur. All the Bush tax cuts will expire, so tax rates will go up on virtually everyone who pays income tax. The payroll tax for Social Security, 2 percentage point payroll tax cut for Social Security will also expire, so that will go up. There will be the beginning of over a decade, $1 trillion in automatic spending cuts from the Defense Department, about half from defense and half from a category of spending called discretionary domestic. Now, that's $1 trillion over a decade.
Right.
So you're talking about roughly $100 billion in any one year, but that process will begin in January. There are a number of other tax increases that would occur because law hasn't been renewed. And altogether, the impact on the economy in 2013 is reckoned, I've seen estimates as high as $700 billion and $500 billion on the sort of the low side. So you're talking about a substantial amount of what economists call drag from higher taxes and lower spending on the economy. I would say there's something else that would happen as well.
What's that?
And that is there's a psychological effect. There's people look at what's going on in Washington. They say these people who we have elected to make difficult choices simply cannot make collectively difficult choices, and that is bound to hurt confidence. And it seems to me there may be then ramifications for that aren't really captured by the economic models that just try to determine what the effects of tax increases and spending cuts would be. So it would be an event. There are people who say, well, we could go over the cliff on January 1st or 2nd, but given that and given the sort of the public reaction, there would probably be an agreement sometime quickly thereafter, and the lingering effects of going over the cliff would be very modest, and that's possible.
James, do you see this more as a political crisis than even an economic or fiscal crisis?
Well, I don't know if it's a crisis at all, but it certainly has its political aspects and its economic aspects. And so there are a couple of things to think about here. And I think that if we do go over the cliff, right around or right after around January 3rd, once Speaker Boehner's speakership is still going to be held intact, I think he'd be much more likely to make some of the negotiations that people feel he should be making right now. Remember, some of those Tea Party folk will then kind of be out of the Republican caucus. And I think once Boehner's position is intact, it will be easier for him to really kind of engage the president in such a way to reach certain compromises. So that's kind of the...
Because taxes would go up.
The taxes would go up, right. And there would be tremendous pressure, right? The president's going to be able to say to the Republican Congress, like, hey, I want to cut taxes for 98% of Americans. And that's, I think, that strategy is quite brilliant. If you go over the cliff, the president can then say that. Mm-hmm. And then so what people in Congress are going to be able to say no to that? And I think that... That's a scenario that the Obama administration has probably thought through and probably anticipates in some ways. But there are also some economic challenges, and I love the idea, because when we talk about economics, we don't talk enough about the behavioral nature of economies and the way that, you know, the way that politics can impact the sort of collective consciousness of those of us who make the economy run. And so things like fiscal cliff, debt ceilings, you know, all the kinds of things that have a lot of this political and media energy around them, when they end up having sort of negative outcomes, there are certain psychological sort of impacts on individuals who help economies run, like how consumers decide how much they're going to save versus what they're going to spend. And those kinds of decisions, sadly, are impacted by politics. And so it's a very complicated sort of morass of politics and economics when we're thinking about the fiscal cliff piece.
Indeed, it is. And Robert Samuelson, going back to you and even looking at it, let's say that the president's plan to essentially keep taxes higher or what they are today on those making over $250,000. Now, we're told it's, you know, 2 or 3% of the population. Can they afford that?
I'm sorry, what do you mean, can they afford it?
Well, I mean, if you're making $250,000, and of course you get taxed on the money you make over that, you know, the tax
right.
applies to the
Just
money
to
you
clear.
Make over $250,000. Does that hurt someone who's making that kind of money?
Well, you know, you'd have to ask them. Nobody likes to pay taxes.
I understand.
Some people think that it's a duty to do so, and I think most Americans believe that. I don't think there's an awful lot of sympathy for people who earn over $250,000 mm-hmm. that they can't afford a little bit more. But doubtlessly, there'll be some people who make $250,000 or $300,000 or even $350,000 or $500,000 who have been irresponsible and taken on too much debt or whatever, and will find the added tax burden personally discomforting. But let me go to a related issue.
Sure.
Supposing the tax increases that the president proposes go into effect, you can't keep repeating them. And they won't come close to closing the deficits entirely. And, you can go to this well once or twice, but you can't keep going back and taxing the rich over and over again for two reasons. One is, at some point, some of these people will just say, well, I'm going to move my money offshore. There are plenty of places in the world where you can go take mm-hmm. your money and shelter it. And it's a sort of, you know, there is international competition for this. And the second reason you can't do it is that at some point you've taxed away almost everything. And people, even the proposals that the president has made now, in combination with state income taxes, would put the top marginal tax rate close to or even above 50% in some states. And at some point, you get disincentive effects. People simply decide not to invest, or they decide not to work harder or whatever, because they don't get to keep very much. You know, it's very difficult to really figure out when that sets in or when it becomes economically important. But in common sense tells you, at some point, taxes can become so oppressive that people simply they react in the behavioral way that Professor Peterson mentioned. So there's a limit to what you can do on the tax side. It's not nothing, and it can be sizable, but it can't cover the whole deficit. And I think what we haven't seen from the administration is really any serious proposal to trim spending.
Well, let me pick up on that and toss that to you, James Peterson. Do you think the Democrats should put some spending cuts on the table? There are some there, but not as, obviously as much as the Republicans want.
There are some, and I think, you know, as Robert's pointing out, we have to have a combination of not just spending cuts, but actually efficient spending, in addition to maybe some of these tax increases. I think that the sort of efficiency plan around Medicare is interesting, and I think that hopefully will stay on the table. I think that the cuts in military spending need to stand. I think that that part of sequestration is important. I believe that the military budget can, and it's such a huge part of what we're talking about in terms of deficit here, that those cuts I think need to stand if we can figure out a way to negotiate that. The challenges with negotiating spending cuts in defense are dealing with all the lobbyists and all the special interests that are invested in the military industrial complex, and so that gets complicated. But I think if that piece of it can remain on the table, I don't understand why Social Security would necessarily have to be a part of this conversation. I understand why Medicare has to be a part of this conversation, because we're about 10 years out from Medicare not being Medicare. So obviously we need to address that, and that's cuts as well as being more efficient in what we spend. It's not just about cutting and slashing these programs. And I think, again, some of it, you know, everything is behavioral in politics, too. Our rhetoric shapes how we perceive some of these things. And so people on the left really don't want to have this discussion about some kind of grand bargain if it means we're going to be slashing Medicare, slashing Medicaid, and even talking about Social Security, which we don't have to talk about in this context. And then you don't hear much talk about, you know, what sequestration was really about in terms of military spending, right? Because that's a pretty big pie as well. So I think if we can have an honest conversation about the kinds of cuts that we need to make, protect investment in research and our own investment in our own people, like, there's not enough humanism in some of these discussions. And I've seen too many people sort of juxtapose increasing taxes on the top 2-3% with cutting Medicare and Medicaid. I don't like those juxtapositions, because when you're cutting Medicare and Medicaid, people are dying. When you're raising taxes, there may be some pressure and there's some economic issues and challenges, but I don't think that they're necessarily equivalent. So I'd love to see a little bit more humanity in some of these discussions, but I don't hear enough talk about the military spending. And you know, when you're talking about cuts, that's a cut those are cuts that can be significant in terms of reducing the deficit.
Well, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. Talking with James Peterson, he's director of Africana Studies, associate professor of English at Lehigh University, a contributor to thegrio.com, and you often can see him on MSNBC. Also with us is Robert Samuelson. He's a columnist for the Washington Post, syndicated by the Washington Post Writers Group, and he also wrote a book called The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath, The Past and Future of American Affluence. We're talking about fiscal cliff politics, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. Currently on view at PAFA, The Female Gaze, Women Artists Making Their World. Over 200 works from the Linda Lee Alter Collection of Art by Women, featuring modern and contemporary artists' depictions of themselves and their communities, a multiplicity of aesthetic viewpoints, working methods, and political perspectives. More information online at PAFA.org. The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY.
Hey, it's John Moe. Join me for Wits, a new show with comedy, conversation, songs, and surprises, recorded live at the Fitzgerald Theater.
Can you curtsy just with your neck?
Amy Sedaris, you're saying that it's okay to do a neck curtsy?
Yeah, he's tall.
We gotta run, run, run before those emus attack.
And then Bobcat Goldthwait was there. Ugh. You know what he said?
I throw my hands up in the air sometimes.
Sunday night at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Jesse Thorne. James Brown wasn't just the minister of the new super heavy funk. He was also the hardest working man in show business.
I think why he connected with Nixon is because he sided with that bootstrap mentality of doing for yourself. You can't trust anybody else, and I can succeed on my own.
Another Side of James Brown with biographer R.J. Smith on the next Bullseye from PRI.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Again, talking about something we're calling fiscal cliff politics with Robert Samuelson, columnist for the Washington Post, and James Peterson from Lehigh University. Just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. Robert, you wrote something recently in the Washington Post. It's headlined, "It's the Welfare State, Stupid." But the what you write and your message is perhaps it's time to rethink entitlements and the fact that about 50% of Americans receive some sort of benefit from the government.
Yeah, let me go back to a point that Professor Peterson made just a moment ago about defense and the nature of the budget. If this were the middle of the 1950s, or even the middle of the 1960s, you could accurately describe defense as the major activity of the federal government. Mm. That is no longer true. The major activity of the federal government today is protecting and supporting retirees, people over 65. Let me just give you some figures to put this in perspective. In 2012, fiscal 2012, which just ended about a month ago, defense spending was $651 billion, which is a lot of money, but that's about 20% of non-interest federal spending. Social Security was $762 billion, that is to say, about $200 billion more than defense. If you look at Medicare, it's another $469 billion, and Medicaid is another $251 billion. So if you want to do anything serious about federal spending, you have got to go to these programs. If you put these programs off limits, you are essentially deciding to do one of three things. One is you are going to substantially reduce everything else the government does: environmental protection, food stamps, the defense, the national parks, the FBI, border control. You go down the list. Over time, meaning over the next 5, 10, 12 years, these programs will have to be reduced substantially if you're going to control the deficit. Or the second thing you'll have to do is raise taxes substantially. And we're not talking about a 2 or 3 or 4% tax increase. We're talking about 15, 20, 25, 30% tax increases. Again, over a decade, 12 years, if you want to sort of pay for those programs and curb the deficits, or you're talking about essentially giving up on deficit reduction and hoping that no financial crisis ever occurs because the United States is running up these large debts. The math of the budget gives you a very simple, straightforward lesson that you have to go after these programs to some extent and decide who deserves to be supported and by how much. I have written about this for years. I think Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid are essential parts of our social system. They're great programs up to a point, but we need to modernize them. We need to come to terms with the realities that exist.
Well, let me give you a chance to respond to that, then we'll get some callers
in.
Well,
I mean, first, I think I wonder how decreased war spending factors into that. And again, I'm not trying to target the military as saying the military is the only place where we need to make cuts. I'm just saying that it has not been a part of the kind of conversations that I've heard in these fiscal cliff discussions. People are talking about Medicare. People are talking about Medicaid. People are talking about the tax increases. And some people are also talking about Social Security. But I don't hear folk talking about the military budget. And so the military budget, I think Robert is right, is one of those big ticket items that's got to be a part of this conversation. But I wonder how the decreased spending based upon getting out of these wars, based upon removing ourselves from some of these situations, actually helps our own economy. But if you look at the numbers that Robert just ran down, I think we need to be thinking through ways in which we can be efficient in some of these programs, like Medicare can become more efficient without necessarily making a whole lot of cuts. And so I think when we're thinking safety net and we're thinking about equivalencies, I'm just interested in making sure that there's more, a little bit more humanity in the discussion, mm-hmm. a little bit less juxtaposition of things that don't have to deal with life and death issues of people's lives versus spending more or having a little bit more or less money. And Robert, this is a question to Robert. How does the U.S. sort of the drawdown of the war wars overseas impact the numbers that you just gave us in terms of the big ticket items in the American economy?
Go ahead, Robert.
Well, it does reduce military spending, but even if you put aside spending on the war, Iraq and Afghanistan, defense spending is going down. In the Budget Control Act, which was passed in 2011, there was $500 billion worth of savings over a decade in defense spending. And people don't talk about it very much, but that's what, and that's not war-related. This is for the
just smarter spending.
Called the base military budget.
Mm-hmm.
And on the path of spending as it exists today, the projections, by early in the next decade, we will be spending about as much on as a share of our economy on the military as we were in 1940 before World War II. It'll be the lowest percentage of GDP since 1940.
Mm-hmm.
So it's and if you cut further, it'll probably be lower than it was
right.
in 1940. So the idea that somehow the defense budget has been ignored in this is just not factually true. The defense budget has taken a huge number of hits, and there are a lot of experts who believe that actually it's gone too far.
Well, I know we could go back and forth
mm-hmm.
on this very particular mm-hmm. point, but I do want to get one more, actually a caller in, and this is John from Chambersburg, Pennsylvania. John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi
Thanks
there.
For taking my call.
You're welcome.
And my question is mostly for Mr. Samuelson. I wanted to ask him is why people like him and the media in general seem to take groups like Fix the Debt seriously. That's a group that's talking about how we need to fix our deficit, in particular when those groups don't seem, those groups, in my view, should love to go over the fiscal cliff because it's going to cut our deficit. Yet when you look at the specific statements that they make and on their website, it seems to me that their biggest concern is don't let taxes go up on the super wealthy.
Well, John.
And secondly.
Well, you know what, John? John, let me take your point only because we only have Robert Samuelson for the next couple of minutes. Your thoughts, Robert Samuelson?
Well, first, I've never written explicitly about fix the debt, that particular group. I think you have to recognize that there is a basic mismatch between the promises that the government has made to various constituencies and the taxes that we now have to support that. So that even if the economy went back to full employment, and there's no guarantee that we're going to hit full employment anytime soon, but supposing it did, there would still be a substantial deficit, and it would grow because we haven't been able to control health costs and because the number of retirees is increasing dramatically over the next 20 years because baby boomers are retiring. So that if you believe, as I do, that we should not, as a matter of prudence, run large budget deficits indefinitely, then you've got to find some way of closing that gap.
Well,
it's simple arithmetic.
Well, even going back to when the Bush-era tax cuts were enacted, that's because there was a government surplus. And I'm looking actually at something from the Congressional Budget Office and looking at what makes the debt, and it looks like those Bush tax cuts are
contributed significantly
are a large portion of that debt.
I'm trying to remember. I did a story on this when this came out. My recollection is the Bush tax cuts were about 40% of the total.
Yes,
the difference, but the larger items were the economy was not as strong as the CBO had projected. There was 9/11, and we reacted to 9/11. And there were some additional programs, Medicare drug benefit that were voted in that enjoyed bipartisan support. So the Bush tax cuts played a role in shifting towards the deficits, but I would say that they were not the main cause.
Well, other single entity in this discussion we just had about this contributed more than the Bush tax cuts did to it. And again, I think I don't know if I disagree with Robert so much. I think that. And when I'm talking about what's been in the conversation about military, I'm talking about what people are talking about, not actually what has happened. He's right. There have been cuts in military. I think there can be additional cuts in military. And let me be clear. I come from a military family, right? I'm not anti-military. I'm just anti-America policing the world if we can't afford to do that. And so I think the if we want to be sensible, we need to be able to talk honestly about all these things and let people understand where we're coming from a political perspective. From a political perspective, I am not interested in destroying the safety net that's been promised to Americans. If we want to be smarter about it, if you want to talk about means testing, if you want to talk about getting some of the middle people out of healthcare, I'm all about that. Let's make it more efficient. If you want to do the same thing in the military, if you want to get the lobbyists out and get the military industrial complex reined in some smart ways, all about those things. I think that raising taxes on the top 2 to 3% over time will have an appropriate effect on both the deficit but also on the social safety net. To me, that's just smarter, you know, smarter sort of spending and allocation of our resources here in America.
Robert Samuelson, you have a minute, and then we have to say goodbye to you. Your final thoughts.
Well, again, just to keep things in perspective, if you had eliminated the Defense Department budget last year, we would have still had a deficit. Now, it would have been substantially smaller, but the deficit was something over $1 trillion, and the defense budget was a little over $600 billion. So it gives you some idea of where we stand here.
I'm not calling for the elimination of the military budget.
Just in terms of the perspective of what you can expect to get by curbing military spending. Military spending is it's substantial. But it is a relatively small part of the total budget now, and it is going to become smaller under present plans without any further cuts.
But would you both agree that if we can figure out how to grow the economy, that would help to solve some of the things we've been talking about?
Yes, but it's a combination of all these things. It's smarter spending and less spending in military, smarter spending in Medicare and Medicaid, increases in taxes for those who are wealthy. I mean, it's the combination of those things that over time will affect the deficit.
Robert Samuelson, we could go on, and we probably should go on.
You know, I don't want to sound mean, but what Professor Peterson says is basically wishful thinking. Everybody would like to be more efficient. The solution to our budget problems has always been cut fraud, waste, and abuse. Well, we ought to try to do all of those things. But the truth is, in the end, you can't expect these kind of painless changes are going to have a really large effect on the deficit. You have to make political choices of one sort or another, and that is what, as a society, we have not been willing to do.
Well, on that note, I do have to end our discussion between the two of you. Robert Samuelson, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. He's a columnist for The Washington Post. James Peterson, Director of Africana Studies, Associate Professor of English at Lehigh University, staying with us for the rest of the hour. The November 6th election, which gave President Obama a second term, revealed some interesting demographic and political trends. He won support from minorities, women, and professionals, a phenomenon our guest Rui Teixeira predicted about a decade ago when he co-authored a book called The Emerging Democratic Majority. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and the Century Foundation. Also wrote something back in November 2011, The Path to 270, Demographics versus Economics in the 2012 Presidential Election. And Rui Teixeira, nice to have you with us on Radio Times, or I should say back with us on Radio Times. I believe I interviewed you about that 2002 book.
That's correct. You did.
And nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. So picking up on these demographic trends, what did you observe 10 years ago that frankly came true in 2012?
Well, in 2002, when John Judas and I put out the book, The Emerging Democratic Majority, our point was broadly that if you looked at how the country was changing in terms of its demographic makeup, certainly including, first and foremost, continuous and rise of minorities that we'd seen to that point, and we thought we'd likely to continue to see the rise of professionals as a group that leaned Democratic, the movement of a lot of women into the Democratic camp, including especially single working and highly educated women, and a number of other changes too were all contributing to an electorate that was going to be, over time, more and more sympathetic to the Democrats and what they stood for, and less sympathetic to the Republicans and what they stood for, and we didn't think that meant the Democrats would win every election, and of course they haven't, but that by and large was going to tilt the political terrain in their favor, and that's what we've seen.
Right. But the idea that this group has core values and beliefs that they have in common.
Yes, I mean, their core beliefs being basically a sort of a welcoming of modernity and the changes that American society is going through, a tolerance of diversity, and of course seeing an important role for government, maybe not in the sort of New Deal, Great Society mold, perhaps not quite that aggressive, but nevertheless a constructive and important one. And that was something, of course, the Republicans have decided it's not the case. In fact, they're vigorously opposed to it.
Does that make sense to you, James?
It does. I mean, demography is destiny for political parties. I think one thing that's interesting and maybe a little bit ironic is that over the course of that time, as that sort of coalition of Democratic-leaning American voters has developed over time, the Democratic Party has become more moderate and maybe some say even more conservative over that same time period. So it's interesting that, you know, I wonder where the left is in some of these discussions, and when we think about these coalitions and these different groups that are at the table, I wonder if the Democratic Party actually serves its constituencies. I wonder if it's really addressing the desires and the sort of issues that the constituencies that they have in this coalition are so that's so diverse and obviously so powerful. I wonder if they're actually addressing the political concerns of these different constituencies.
Well, that's interesting. Do you see a disconnect really between this coalition of groups that put Obama back into the White House? See a disconnect between them and the party that they voted for?
I think at times we do see a disconnect in the sense that the party may actually be a little bit to the right of the constituencies that give them support. I mean, I don't think it's entirely the case, though, that some of the relative moderation of today's Democratic Party compared to the Democratic Party many decades ago is entirely attributable to the disconnect. I think the country itself has changed, and people's views of, you know, what are the appropriate roles of government, what are the appropriate levels of spending. And there's a little bit more suspicion of government and its role now that, among all parts of the population than there used to be. That said, I think we do have a case at times in the Democratic Party where, let's face it, the people who contribute the most money to keeping the party afloat sometimes have more influence than the folks who contribute less. And there's always, in addition to that, there's ideology has its effect. I mean, and there was an ideology that went back, for example, to the 1990s in terms of the sort of economics practiced by the Clinton administration that basically saw the market and the financial sector as being you know, the drivers of prosperity, and that it's really important for the government to get out of the way in many respects. And the Clinton administration, for example, was not innocent of some of the things that happened to the economy in the 2000s because they, in fact, participated in some of that deregulation. So I think sometimes there is this disconnect between the people who have the most economic power and the most influence on the highest levels of the party and the base of the party.
And we have 30 seconds before a second break. But what does it mean to be a liberal, James Peterson?
Yeah,
these days,
you know, I mean, I think it's hard for liberals to identify with the Democratic Party sometimes. You know, liberals can't support drone attacks. You know what I mean? They can't support the direction that we're going in terms of educational reform. They can't support conversations about slashing Medicare and Medicaid in the face of raising taxes 2 or 3 points on the top 2%. And so there are a lot of challenges for liberals within the Democratic Party, and there's been a little bit of infighting. Okay.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with James Peterson and Rui Teixeira. We're talking about the coalition of groups, including minorities, women, and professionals, as our guest Rui Teixeira described, who helped to put the president back into office, into the White House, and what does that mean about electoral politics. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Thomas Jefferson University Hospital supports WHYY. Jefferson Orthopedics helps patients with hip, knee, foot, ankle, shoulder, and spinal problems and with sports injuries and offers minimally invasive surgical procedures. Jefferson nurses and physical therapists employ post-operative rehab treatments designed to help patients resume their normal activities and lifestyle. To schedule an appointment or for further details, 1-800-JEFF-NOW or jeffersonhospital.org.
Is it okay to break up with someone with an email? If you're out at a restaurant with someone, is it rude to answer your cell phone, check email, or tweet? On the next Fresh Air, we get answers from Philip Galanis, who writes an etiquette column for the New York Times. His book, Social Cues, is now out in paperback. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
We'll be right back. I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Dorothy Day, social activist and hero of the Catholic left, is up for sainthood. So why is the conservative cardinal one of her biggest supporters? And how did Daniel Ellsberg's son get involved? Also, the Supreme Court will decide which of several petitions on gay marriage it will hear. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. We're talking about the changing nature of the American electorate, and Nuri Chashira with us, one of the nation's leading demographers, a fellow at the Century Foundation and the Center for American Progress. James Peterson, also with us, director of Africana Studies at Lehigh University. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Rui, even though looking at the women, the minorities, the so-called professionals who did vote for President Obama, is it that the Democrats embraced them, the president embraced them, or was it that the Republicans pushed them away? And I'm thinking about all the discussions about forcible rape or contraception or self-deportation. Was it a push or a pull?
Well, I think both things are operative. I mean, there's no question that the Republicans did a lot to shoot themselves in the foot with taking some of the more extreme positions. For example, might be the Latino population and the way the Republican primary candidates and Romney himself were so strenuous in opposing elite, you know, sort of being taking a very stern line in immigrants. You know, Romney famously called for self-deportation and so on. This is a sort of thing that seems maybe a little bit over the top, even given their fundamental positions. But let's not forget what their fundamental positions are on things like immigration and on things, for example, of concern to Latinos, the whole Republican position on government and how little it should be funded and how few services should be provided and, you know, so on and so forth. All that's really anathema to a population that is, by and large, the most pro-government and liberal on economic issues population in the United States. So it's not just the Republicans make mistakes, it's that their positions are at variance with the positions these constituencies believe in and endorse, and that in fact to a greater or lesser degree are embodied by the Democratic Party and by President Obama and the kind of policies he's pursued. So I think both push and pull are clearly very important. You know, but there's no doubt that the Republicans didn't play their cards well, even if their cards had problems to begin with. So I think both things are important.
Would you throw gays and lesbians into that coalition, Rui?
Of course I'd throw. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it was just really just hitting the high points of the coalition. Gays and lesbians are important. Secular voters are important. Of course, let's not forget the younger generation, the millennial generation of voters, you know, starting from around 1980, who clearly are a distinctive cohort in American politics that have a very different view of the role of government and of social issues and a variety of other things that makes them by far the most liberal cohort in the electorate. And these voters are continuing to support Democrats in huge numbers. And there are some people who made the argument after the election, and it's an interesting one, is that if there's the rise of minorities is obvious and conspicuous and important, but the rise of this younger generation over the long term could be just as important, maybe even more important, because it's just a generational shift in American politics. It's just going to have huge implications. These voters keep on coming into the electorate. They keep on voting Democratic. They keep on having fundamentally different values and views of the role of government than the generations that preceded them, and that's huge.
James Peterson, there have been calls in various states for secession. Do you take that seriously? Is this sour grapes? Should we take this seriously?
Well, I think we should take it seriously in terms of understanding that the people who are engaged in these so-called secessionist movements are from the states that we would think that they would be from. They represent those areas of the population that are probably a little bit more racialized in terms of their thinking. They're more conservative in terms of their political positions, more orthodox and intense in terms of their religious beliefs, and also happen to be from the class of Americans who rely a bit more on government intervention and government support. And so the combination of those things, and this is this what I wrote about for the Daily Beast, the combination of those things to me is quite ironic. But we don't need to take it serious in terms of, is Texas going to secede? No, they actually, you know, they're out of all the states, they're one of the only states that could maybe barely afford to secede. Most of the other states literally could not afford to exist or subsist outside of the Union of the United States. But I think what we should take seriously is that there are people who have a lot of anxiety about the demographics that Mr. Teixeira is talking about here. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of anxiety about that. And some of that manifests itself in just straight racial animus. Some of it manifests itself in what Mr. Obama regrettably called clinging to religion, but like going to doctrines. And some of it will manifest itself mm-hmm. in these kind of you know, misdirected political movements, like the secessionist movement or the Tea Party movement, for example. That anxiety has permeated a pretty significant group of the American population in some of these what we refer to as red states. And I think that demography is being confronted in some ways by some of the racial ideology that we see coming out of them.
And do you think there's something the Democratic Party can do to win over these people?
I think there is. I think the and we're actually doing a starting to do a little bit of work of this at the Center for American Progress. I mean, it's become clear for a number of years that the weakest spot in the Democrats' coalition, this rising Obama coalition, if you will, is the sort of relative lack of appeal to white, non-college, or working-class voters, that they formed the bulwark of the opposition to Obama in most states, most parts of the country. And we know from other polling data that this is the most pessimistic group in America, and this is a group that sees basically this rising diversity as more being a threat to their way of life than something that really helps the country. And they don't feel like they and their children are going to come out well at the end of this process. So I think what the Democrats have to do is basically push programs that really promote vigorously economic opportunity and relatively better jobs for these kinds of voters, as well as all voters. I mean, that's really what's lacking in this country, is that sense of opportunity is ebbing for a lot of people, including white non-college voters, but including a lot of other voters too. And if you develop a more robust economy, make education more widely available to people, sort of have the economy embark on a path that produces better jobs for more people, I think that, in fact, I mean, you know, it's a long question how we can do that, but that is really the essence of it. I don't think these voters are going to respond positively and affirmatively to the Democratic Party until they see their future reflected in the vision of the Democratic Party. And right now, they tend to see the Democratic Party as a little bit of an outsider, as a sort of advocate for these emerging constituencies, but not necessarily for them.
How do you see it, James?
Well, they see them, he's right. They see them as the takers and as the invaders. And again, when you see these things manifest themselves in someone like a Sheriff Arpaio in Arizona, or the kind of policies that come in response to that anxiety, that's, I think, what we have to take very, very seriously. And yes, and a better economy might reflect better for this sort of constituency, but I wonder what they see on the other side. I mean, on the other side, you don't see a party that's really for working class people. You don't see a party that's really for the kind of government support that allows the states that these people live in really exist. And so, I think that there are political blind spots for both parties. And speaking to this particular constituency is about economics, but I think it's also about making sure that we have a concerted effort to address some of these crazy racialized policies that come out of their fear. I think Stand Your Ground is the kind of law that gets support because of these kinds of feelings. And when you see the worst cases of it, some of these are racialized, and some of them are generational and otherwise. But when we look at some of the policies, whether it's immigration policy or gun control policy, you know, this is where the secessionist delusion becomes really, really serious, because these are the same folk that are allowing those laws and voting for those laws and supporting the kind of laws that I think are really retrograde and reactionary.
Let me get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. We have Paul from Center City, Philadelphia, joining us. And Paul, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Thank you very much for taking the call.
You're
I just
welcome.
Want to say that I very strongly agree with exactly what Mr. Peterson just said, or Dr. Peterson just said. But my question is about something a little bit different.
Sure.
I understand that the House of Representatives actually Democratic candidates for the House this past election that received more votes, popular vote-wise, than Republican candidates did. But because of the way that states have been districted, mostly by Republican state legislatures, the House of Representatives is still in Republican hands. It really shouldn't be if you go by the popular vote. And I wonder if this situation is fixable, if the folks that you have on your show today have any kind of thoughts about that.
Yeah, and this goes on every 10 years, Paul. There's districting and redistricting. Rui, let me toss that first to you, Rui.
Yes, no, that is correct. The Democrats did get a slight majority of the popular vote for the House, and they didn't obviously take back the House. And that does have something to do with the way the districts were drawn after the last census. The Republicans had control of that process and more places than the Democrats did, and they were quite willing to play hardball to protect their incumbents. So that's a factor. Now, that said, how long can we expect this to go on? There are people who are saying, oh, this is so devilish what the Republicans did, that there's no chance the Democrats will ever take back the House before the next census. And the funny thing is, they said the same thing after the 2000 census. And, of course, it wasn't the case that the entire decade went by before the Democrats took back the House. Now, the reason for that is that sometimes politics overwhelms the redistricting of boundaries, and very important, the districts themselves change over time.
Right.
They draw these districts
right.
in the way that they best think they can protect their incumbents, but the pesky
sometimes.
People keep on changing
that
they put in those districts.
Right.
The people move, the diversity continues to emerge, whatever. Lots of things happen, and before you know it, a lot of these boundaries aren't quite as safe as they once thought. They're vulnerable, and the suitable wave comes along. A lot of these people get swept away. So I think we'll see the same thing happening this decade. It didn't happen for the Democrats this time, but it'll happen sometime and probably a lot sooner than we think.
Go ahead.
The caller makes a really important point, which is that Congress is broken, and it's broken in three primary ways. One, the use and misuse of the filibuster. Two, the lobbying and the money that sort of controls how votes are cast. And three is the ways in which districts are drawn and redrawn to protect incumbents. We need to have a sort of comprehensive Congress reformation, I think, to really move legislation more fluidly in our country to address some of the challenges that we have. But those three things, I think, are of urgent need to be addressed. How the filibuster is used, the amount, and I don't know if people understand the extent to which lobbying dictates and determines how voting occurs there, but it's insane. And for those folks who have been in Washington, they can see it kind of more firsthand. And then we've got to, it's not just Republicans who gerrymander districts, by the way, but we do need to have some kind of policy in place, laws in place that can reduce the effect that gerrymandering has on protecting incumbents.
Making it less partisan.
Yes.
Let me see what Sean from the Northeast has to say. Sean, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thanks.
You're welcome.
So I consider myself a part of the working class culture and the community that you guys were just speaking of. And I feel that essentially the reason why there is no party for that class and why I don't hear much about them is because we're the class that doesn't need the government. We don't need the help. We don't need the assistance. We're not taking on the entitlements. We're just kind of part of the machine, paying the taxes and living day to day.
And by that, you mean, Sean, that you're not, what do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is everything that you guys are discussing on cutting and cutting the spending on X, Y, and Z doesn't affect us at all. We don't need any assistance from the government.
You don't need Medicare. You don't need Social Security.
No. Correct. Correct. We're just working. We're paying into it. We're working day to day. None of that affects us.
It comes out of your paycheck.
Yes, it does.
And if and when you retire, you will receive some of those benefits.
Correct. But I think we're too busy working day to day, living for today, trying to survive today, to worry about 50 years from now.
Well, I understand.
I understand it.
But hopefully you'll be around 50 years from now, and perhaps we'll get some of those benefits. Let me see if Rui Teixeira has something to say. Sean, thanks for calling into Radio Times, Rui.
Yeah, well, I think Sean has neatly encapsulated, the fundamental premise about American government and American social policy that has driven so much of the conservative reaction against
liberals and against the Democrats for many decades, and has moved the white working class, for example, from a fairly pro-democratic group into a pretty pro-Republican group. The idea is pretty simple. I pay my taxes, I pay lots of taxes, and I don't really get anything from the government in return that I really need or that really works. So therefore, they're taking money out of my pocket, and they're putting it in someone else's pocket, and that's a bad thing. And so to a greater or lesser extent, that assessment of that drives a lot of these voters I personally don't think that's entirely correct. It might even not even be correct in Sean's case, but I mean, that is how they feel.
Absolutely absurd for multiple reasons. One, does the caller not have any parents or grandparents? The caller doesn't have anyone who's ever benefited from government support or government intervention. Does the caller drive on highways? Does the caller call the police when they want to get help? Does the caller need the fire department when their house is on fire? Was the caller ever educated in a public school system? It's absurd. The idea that we're going to have a conversation about government. This is what I mean when we don't add in all the pieces and there's not enough humanism in the discussion. How can we be talking about just, cutting Medicare and cutting Medicaid without thinking about the lives that it impacts? So to that caller, respectfully, I'm sure that you have parents and or grandparents. I'm sure that you had public school, or if not, you understand and appreciate the value of public school, the value of police, the value of fire departments, the value of bridges, roads, the infrastructure upon which your working class is predicated upon the fact that our government has done certain things. And so I'm obviously not one of these folk that believe that government is the bad guy. I do believe in efficiency. I do believe in compassion and things of that nature. But at the end of the day, this rhetoric that I'm just this rugged individual and I'm working class, I'm too busy. Look, dude, I work and pay taxes too. You know what I mean? But that doesn't mean that I'm ignorant about what's going on in America in terms of the government's role and what it is that we do every day.
Well, they're playing my song. We have to end our discussion. James Peterson, no, that's okay. Thank you for joining us today on Radio Times. You're very welcome. And he is a director of Africana Studies at Lehigh University. Rui Tashir, thank you very much as well.
My pleasure.
And he's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and the Century Foundation, one of the country's foremost political demographers. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about this program, including Facebook and Twitter. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us, though. We'll be right back. And in the second hour of Radio Times today, meet actor